we've been very cognizant of that at US Gold, and that's why we have such an amazing share structure today. You know, we want to keep a very, very tight share structure, because when we do get into discovery, you're going to see fireworks, and that's going to be a huge return for shareholders because of that tight share structure.
You are listening to Mining Stock Education. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Powers, your host. Well, today we're going to be talking about a company that I'm invested in, that being US Gold Corp. US Gold Corp is also a sponsor of this show. Last year, you might remember, if you're an avid follower, that I interviewed Dave Mathewson, who is the lead geologist for US Gold Corp. I found out that that was a very popular interview, especially with geologists. I happened to be in the subway in Vancouver last summer when I was going to the Sprott Conference and began chatting with the geologist next to me on the subway, and he referenced a recent interview with Dave Mathewson, which he really liked because he was a geologist himself. Dave leads up the exploration for US Gold Corp and has an excellent reputation in the industry and amongst geologists because he has been a key factor and a leader in finding many million ounces of gold there in Nevada. Well, I'm not speaking with Dave Mathewson today. I will be speaking with Luke Norman, a very successful mining entrepreneur. He's a seasoned mining executive and business builder. Luke has over 15 years experience in the venture capital markets, and he's been responsible for the direct capital raises in excess of $300 million. He's also the co-founder of a successful company, Gold Standard Ventures, which was listed on the TSXV and New York Stock Exchange American. And through discovery, he led that company from a $15 million market cap all the way up to $1 billion market cap Canadian. With that being said, Luke, thanks for coming on the show and joining me today.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
For those that don't know your background, could you speak a little more about your pedigree and the success you had in particular with Gold Standard Ventures there in Nevada?
Yeah, I mean, my pedigree, as you've put it, I started out with a very keen interest in the late 90s, actually, in the gold exploration space. I just felt that there was going to be a lot of follow through from what was happening in the tech space. I thought that capital would start to open back up into the gold mining space. Of course, you have to remember back to 1997 when the BRIEX scandal occurred. It really had wiped out the miners. Had a horrible effect on the gold investment space and sector overall. So I felt that that was in sort of a ground situation, bottom situation, and that was a good time to get involved. So in the late 90s, I looked to fund a small junior. I went and met with several brokers around North America, and one in particular in Vancouver, Canada. His name is Ian Gordon, or is Ian Gordon. He was a very active investor in the space at the time, and he said, look, I'll help fund your junior, but you have to quit that company and come and work with me. So in the late 90s and early 2000s, he and I went on a program of tracking down new investors, more in particular institutional investors in the space, and we introduced them to new early stage opportunities in the middle in the gold exploration and development space in particular. From there, I recognized very quickly that we were raising a lot of money for a lot of companies, but a lot of those companies weren't meeting their milestones. They weren't achieving the things that they would profess they'd be achieving in these meetings. And very quickly, I recognized that management was a very key ingredient to the success of these juniors. So, you know, the old adage, if you want it done right, do it yourself. I moved from funding other people's opportunities to funding opportunities that I felt were worthy of time and effort, but got more involved in the managemental side and helping structure these. So that morphed into a really keen interest in one project in particular. It was tied up in a junior, and that project was called the Railroad Gold Project. It was in on the Carlin Trend in Nevada. So I focused about 5 years of my time acquiring that project. And then myself, Dave Mathewson, and Jonathan Ord, who's still the CEO over at Gold Standard today, began what is now Gold Standard. So we had a really, really tough road with that company because, of course, we were founding it in trying to fund it through the 08 and 09 meltdown that was occurring in the US. So capital was very, very scarce at the time, especially for junior explorers. But we managed to put that company together. And as you mentioned, it was about a $15 million market cap when we began. But we realized that, you know, these opportunities, that is a district scale opportunity on a major gold trend in Nevada, can really have a huge impact on you as a company and on you as an individual if you can get into a discovery there. So Gold Standard was one of the successful companies, I think probably the most analogous to what we're going to discuss today. So we'll sort of point to that.
Like at Gold Standard, you're working with Dave Mathewson again, and Dave had said that railroad project, as excellent as it was, your current project, Keystone, he said, is like railroad on steroids, and it's the best exploration project that he's seen in his career. Before we talk about the specifics of it, can you talk about how you actually went about acquiring this project?
Yeah, for sure. It's quite a process in Nevada because you've got hundreds of years of underlying owners and claims within any kind of district like that, where you have the legal obligation to track down all those owners and essentially cut a deal with them. And if you don't, you end up with holes in key sections of the project, that you make a discovery and those holes become very, very, very valuable, or can be very what we'll call nuisance claims to the future development of a project like that. So you really have to take your time and spend a lot of money on your diligence to make sure that you have encapsulated all of the ownership within the key sections of what you deem to be that district before you can proceed. So with Railroad, that was a process that took us there have been years and years of work prior to us going into the project. A gentleman by the name of John Ualdi was the original owner of Railroad. 40 years he had owned the center of that project. But over time, he had lost key sections of it off to different companies, etc., just because of the expense of being a private owner of a big land package like that. You have Bureau of Land Management payments every August of every year, or beginning of September, excuse me, but you know, that can be very hard on an underlying owner. So we were cognizant of that. We cut a deal with Miss Ualdi's family. He had passed away, and then began the work on surrounding owners. So it was even more of a process actually at Keystone, and Dave Mathewson completely was at the helm of that ship in regard to tying together Keystone District. And it was about a 25-year process for him. So he owned key sections within Keystone, but the bulk of Keystone was actually owned by a company called Placer Dome. And Placer Dome, of course, ended up being taken out by Barrick in 2007 because of their Cortez Hills discovery. So 25-year process, but we think well worth the effort.
So Dave Mathewson obviously saw something that he wanted in Keystone, but for those with maybe a little more skeptical perspective, and they might say, well, didn't Placer Dome already explore this already? What would be your response to that?
Placer Dome, to all our records that we see, did not put in a very extensive exploration focus towards it. Cortez Hills was the most common sense one for them to focus on because they already had the Cortez mine, they had pipeline. Both of those projects are about 10 miles north of us. And their additional land holdings off of those two mines spread to the south. And they recognized very early on that they had the right setting, they had all the right rocks, they obviously already had two very significant gold deposits, that they would start looking along the structural corridor that is, you know, within the Cortez mine, and start looking for offshoot mineral deposits. And what they end up finding was probably the heart of that district in the Cortez Hills deposit. I mean, it's a known 25 million ounce deposit today, and there are guesstimates or estimates by outsiders. Barrick don't do a lot of disclosure in that regard, from my view anyway. It could be wrong, but that there's a lot more upside to that. And then beyond the Cortez Hills deposit, of course, they've now made four or five other significant discoveries within that land package.
What makes Keystone, when Dave and yourself looks at Keystone, what are some of the features that makes this so prospective?
We'll sort of go back to Dave's quote about it being railroad on steroids. What you look for, these districts, how they're generated is, 30 plus million years ago, it was a very active geological area. You had magma bodies that were pushing up through the bottom of the Earth's crust, through these big cracks, such as the what's known as the Carlin Trend, away to our northwest, of course. It was a 50-mile long crack in the Earth's crust. It allowed magma to seep up through that crack, and in doing so, that magma forced lower plate rocks that are usually thousands and thousands of feet deep, forced them up towards the surface, and then ultimately infused those rocks with gold deposits. So all along the Carlin Trend, there's four windows known on the Carlin Trend, railroad and gold standard, of course, is one of those. Well, on the Cortez Trend, it's an identical type of setting. You've had this crack in the Earth's crust. It's allowed this magma to force these domal uplifts of lower plate rocks. So what Dave's referring to when he says he feels that Keystone is railroad on steroids, that's due to the fact that at Railroad, we were hunting one particular limestone lower plate rock formation known as Devil's Gate Limestone that exists throughout the project. But ultimately, it's about a 200 to 300 foot formation of limestone that you hope to intercept somewhere close to a fluid-bearing structure and look for a gold deposit within those key areas. Well, at Keystone, we have stacked formations similar to that ilk of rock, that Devil's Gate type limestone environment, but to the tune of thousands of feet of stacked limestones. So when you get into the right structure, hopefully the right fluid-bearing structure, you've got four or five different candidates of host rock within your stratigraphy that any or all of them could be a permissive host of a gold deposit. So you are looking for massive swaths of gold within an environment like that. And the other thing that was pretty prevalent to us at Keystone that we have since proven with some of the work we've done, both through drilling and some theses done by graduate students, etc., is that not only was there just one magma source that fed the Keystone district that we own, but there was as many as five intrusives. And we believe that over three different periods, there was activity within those intrusives that could have led, any one of those pulses could have led to a really significant gold deposit. So you've got three kicks at the can, as it were, in terms of the intrusive interaction within these lower plates that have been brought up close to surface so that we can economically viably explore them, and then ultimately, hopefully, once we get into a deposit, develop them.
So where are we at this year in 2019? What are some of the key catalysts, and when will we bring in the truth machine out to Keystone to test some of these theses?
Well, we've had the truth machine obviously on the project for about 18 months, but it's a very, very strict model-driven approach to this style of exploration. A junior can blow their brains out drilling holes willy-nilly all over a 20 square mile project like this, because these gold deposits are not massive in their footprint, and I'll touch on that in a bit. They're actually quite contained. They're especially in the Cortez Hills type environment deposit that we're looking for. These are actually plumes of feeder, essentially, where you've had a very enriched zone of fluids being forced directly up through these rocks along a fault. So they're contained and relatively small in size. Cortez Hills, as I said, 25 million plus ounces, is actually about a 500 foot diameter plume of brecciation that contains that gold mineralization. So you could spend tens upon tens of millions of dollars and not necessarily make a discovery if you went in there and just drilled on by gut or by, you know, a sort of a potluck type approach. And instead, what we have to do is we do very extensive. Initially, we did scout drilling. The scout drilling was just to tell us, is it even worth going about all the other methods we need to do to find a gold deposit? But the scout drilling was key for us to understand what is the stratigraphy, or what are these stacked up rock hosts, hopefully, that exist on the project or don't exist on the project. So we basically took a four corners approach with a scout drilling program. That is, drill each four corners of the project and then sort of drill some areas within the center of the project and get a feeling for what we're dealing with rock type. So we spent quite a bit of time and money, even pre going public, just understanding what is our environment, what kind of rock host do we have. And we're really excited, obviously, as you've heard through Dave's analogy, with what we interacted, or what we found through that process. So then you take a real step back and you have to think, right, well, how does this all tie together? How are we going to find, within this correct stacked host environment, how are we going to find the hot spots of where mineralization should occur? And that's a combination of geophysics. Geophysics, in our prime use of geophysics, is what's known as gravity. We look for differences in rock densities over thousands of points of electrical interaction, basically sending pulses down through the rocks, and they're measured back to the ground station in nanoseconds. And you look for differences within the timing of those returns. And ultimately, if you've got a lineal passageway whereby 20 feet to your left, you're getting a certain signature back, and 20 feet over to your right, you're getting a different signature. One can assume that that's two different densities of rock, that being you have some sort of fault and either a downdrop or an uplift, and that fault is usually a fluid conduit. So we look for all these structures. We spend a lot of time doing that. We're still performing gravity on the project today to tighten up that understanding. So we look for structural corridors or fluid corridors and conduits, and then geochemistry. At surface, we do thousands upon thousands of assay samples with rocks and soils, and we're looking for indications of these gold deposits, because the gold is locked up very tightly in these gold deposits, but there are transient pathfinder minerals within them, such as arsenic and antimony and barite and different things that do leach out of the deposits, but you can find them enriched in the soils and the rocks up and away from the main deposits. So what you want to look for is enriched areas of pathfinder minerals overlaid by some sort of structural corridor rolling through, and now you know that you're near to what could be a very hot spot and a high probability target area for a gold deposit.
Will there be reverse circulation drilling later this year to test some of these targets?
Yes, there will. Because one thing that I think possibly was, you know, a little bit of frustration for our early stage investors is, part of this process, when you own a 20 square mile project in Nevada, when you own it, you know, through lease, but ultimately the Bureau of Land Management have control of that area of land in terms of what you can or cannot do without being properly bonded and properly set up and having all the right environmental assessments and archaeological studies, is you have to compile all of that information and send it off to the BLM, and they then evaluate whether you can go on and do an extensive exploration program. If you've got all sorts of archaeological finds, and if you have you know, some sort of you know, protected animal environment or any of these sort of things that can occur in that part of the world, they don't want you disturbing those areas, and you're pretty much hamstrung, and you can't go and explore, and you can't develop. So that was about a 2.5 year process for us to compile all that information and get it over to the BLM and then await their approval. So the little bit of exploration work we did, the little bit of drilling we did, was in areas where we could get approvals for slight disturbances on the project. Then thankfully, at the tail end of September of last year, which is unfortunately right towards the end of our drilling season, but we were finally given full approval by the BLM through what they call a plan of operation to now be more aggressive with our exploration undertaking. That is, we can start to put in roads into key target areas that we really wanted to explore, we really wanted to drill test, but we just didn't have the permitting to do so at the time. So it's a big undertaking, but very happy to report that we do have that in hand now.
It's crucial as early stage gold speculators that we understand these time frames. Otherwise, we can get frustrated quite quickly. When you were at the helm of Gold Standard Ventures, what was the time frame from when you started to explore to when you actually made that first big discovery hole?
Well, I better correct you there, because I've never officially been at the helm of Gold Standard. I was very much joined at the helm in terms of my involvement to build the company, to bring the asset to the company, etc. But the helm certainly was held by, of course, our CEO and the directors and managers of the company. I remained actually with Gold Standard, a very similar role to what I have with US Gold today, which was a co-founder of the company. I made the push to acquire the asset. I used my capital at the time to acquire the railroad project. I funded the company. I helped market the company. I helped bring in key sections of the company, such as the pinion sections of railroad, which is now the real value driver over at Gold Standard. And likewise at US Gold, that's my involvement. I was pivotal to obviously raising the capital, bringing in the Keystone project alongside Dave Matheson. Dave Matheson is the one person who deserves all the credit for tying together the Keystone district. I think maybe comparatively over at Railroad, myself and John Ord probably wore that crown for tying together that district. So my role within the company has been to bring all of the key ingredients together, which is the right project, the right management, and the funding, the capital, all important capital. But the one key difference, I think, between what we're trying to achieve here at US Gold to maybe Gold Standard is, and with Gold Standard, we were, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we were going through the 08, 09 down cycle. We went through another down cycle through 2012, 13, 14. So it was a very, very dilutive process for all of us. You know, I have to laugh when I get shareholders yelling at me about dilution within the company. I mean, nobody wants to dilute less than I. When I've, you know, cut the hard checks at the beginning, when no one wants to cut a check, the last thing I want to do is watch my percentage ownership in the company just get smashed. So we've been very cognizant of that at US Gold, and that's why we have such an amazing share structure today. You know, only 17.8 million shares out compared to, you know, well over 300 million, I believe, now with Gold Standard. So we're cognizant of that. We want to keep a very, very tight share structure, because when we do get into discovery, you're going to see fireworks, and that's going to be a huge return for shareholders because of that tight share structure versus a very diluted share structure. It seems to move the market capitalization, you know, abruptly, but on a per share basis, you're kind of left scratching your head going, well, that wasn't the returns I was hoping for.
Could you give us some comparables of Nevada Gold discoveries in recent years that, you know, maybe you're in your mind, you're comparing the potential of Keystone to?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, again, of course, we've got to point to Gold Standard. That's the obvious one, you know, where, you know, market cap wise, you saw a $15 million shift to damn near $1 billion Canadian at one point in time. But in a share price shift, that's literally the stock going from around 50 cents to around $3, about $4. So, you know, what's that, 800% multiple or so? I think the best example, probably because their share structure was a bit better, but more importantly, they had the luck of just great market timing, would be Frontier Gold. And Frontier Gold co-owned a project called Long Canyon. They co-owned it with a company called OreX Resources. They got into a really nifty discovery in a new district, quite far west, about 60 or 80 miles west of the Carlin Trend. And through that discovery, very early into that discovery, all the majors started showing a lot of interest. So there was a very competitive environment in Nevada. Everybody wants into Nevada. You know, you've seen Barrick with trying to divest out of Nevada previously with the work they did down in Argentina/Chile, where they had, but they spent close to $9 billion developing an ore body down there only to basically turn around and walk away. People recognize now that the best jurisdiction on the planet to own a gold mine, to be in production, is Nevada. So because of that, discoveries lead to these very, very big premiums. So the Frontier Gold discovery ended up becoming a $2.3 billion takeover of that junior. So that was, I think, a $10 or $12 stock by the time that was taken out by Newmont, you know, from around a 30-cent share price when they first started exploring it. So those are the kind of returns we're all looking for, really. We want that lottery ticket for you know, a big return. And that's what I think, you know, the style of district we have in Keystone would, you know, tie very nicely to those kind of massive returns if we get into discovery. Because you own the entire district, which means a big mining company can come in, they can develop, but they can also make sure that no one's on their heels. They can find additional deposits and any infrastructure that they already own within that, you know, sort of larger jurisdiction can come into play and really cut down their capital costs. So Newmont, Barrick, absolutely. But we've seen the amount of investment that Goldcorp has put into the juniors in Nevada lately. We know that Goldcorp was trying to align itself, obviously, with or still is aligning itself with Newmont to some degree. There is a multitude of mining companies, gold mining companies in particular, that really want inroads into Nevada. So a discovery on a project like Keystone would be, you know, lights out for U.S. gold.
Yes, Keystone truly offers the blue sky potential, but one of the things I like about U.S. Gold Corp. is that you also have fundamental value established in the company already in your Copper King project. But before we talk about Copper King, I just want to mention, for those that don't know, U.S. Gold Corp. trades on the NASDAQ, which is very unique for a gold exploration company to be trading on the big board there under the ticker USAU, and it's an extremely tight share structure. Right now, only 19.3 million shares out, with a market cap about $17 million the day we're recording this interview. Copper King is in Wyoming. There's already a preliminary economic assessment done on this that comes, the net present value comes in at $178.5 million. And I did the math, just some rough calculations this morning, Luke, and the current valuation per share, your shares are trading at about 1/11th of that NPV. Would you say that's undervalued right now?
Yeah, I always caution myself about saying what is or isn't undervalued or reasonably valued, because the argument, of course, back to you is always, well, the market's never wrong. But statistically and comparatively to our peer group, that asset is trading at a far greater discount than anything that I, and there is, when I, you know, invite your listeners to please, you know, go to our website, which is usgold.gold. Or usgoldcorp.gold, excuse me, and there's a very good presentation that shows some of those comps and some of the valuation metrics that are used on some of our peer group. And yeah, I think that it's grossly mispriced within even this gold environment right now. I think as you say, you know, we've got, you know, just over about a $17 or $18 million market cap, maybe not even right now, with an asset like that in it. And you know, it's a real meat and potatoes kind of foundation asset that's sitting in our company right now, and, you know, valued where it is, yeah, there's a real proposition for, I'd say, more upside than downside. How about we put it that way?
And your inputs for the preliminary economic assessment there, you used 1275 gold and 280 copper. And as we record this interview, gold's at 1315 and copper is at 288. So that NPV obviously would be higher with those inputs.
Well, but what would... I was going to say there's some other inputs as well that, you know, we're working feverishly on in the background that we feel that could really adjust those numbers too. And that is previous work done on the project that a lot of those drill holes were used for this PEA weren't assayed for some key metals that are locked in that mineral deposit, such as silver and zinc, for example. And we think there's about a 30% undervaluation on the per ton rock within the Copper King deposit. We think that those credits, are about, because they're not included in the PEA, probably have that rock price at about a 30% discount to it. And also, in addition to that, we conducted a small drilling program, but that's all we had to do last year, just to test some of the lateral boundaries of the deposit. That is the deposit fully drilled, or is there upside to it? And lo and behold, we found some great step out drill holes that would fit in nicely to the core of this deposit in terms of from a production profile. So we think that there's probably at least 30 to 50% upside to the deposit in terms of its size. And again, significant additional value to unassayed inputs.
How does the state of Wyoming feel about this project?
Look, the feedback we've got is almost to the point of them pushing us towards a development decision. They need the employment. They want the employment, of course. The other beauty of Wyoming, I will add as well, is it's actually state-run or state-controlled. These mining situations, that being that it's not federally run by the Bureau of Land Management, within the state of Wyoming, these decisions are made. So we've been getting all the right language from the state of Wyoming for us to be able to go ahead and advance this project. Obviously, there's a lot of permitting similar to that plan of operation that we had to take care of in Nevada through a mine permitting process. It would be even more extensive at Copper King, but the typical environmental impact studies, archaeological studies, etc. But all in all, we've had great feedback from the state of Wyoming and even an indication from them that they would be interested in helping fund the capex of putting this into production. So for them, it's just a plus.
In Wyoming, isn't there less federal regulation in terms of permitting mines? Don't you deal more with the state than the federal government in that jurisdiction?
Exactly. That's I was sort of leaning towards that, but just went off on a tangent. But absolutely, instead of dealing with the Bureau of Land Management, we'd be dealing with the state government. And again, they're pretty proactive. They want to see development. They want to see advancement. They want to see employment. It's a great way. It would be a great poster child for them in Wyoming to have another mine in production. I mean, there was a lot of coal production in Wyoming back in the day. There still is coal production in Wyoming, but they want to see some general interest from explorers and developers, and they want to see that infrastructure, and they want to see their state flourish. They want to be a producer.
As I mentioned at the outset, I own shares in U.S. Gold Corp and want to see it succeed. It's also a sponsor of this show. To learn more, you can go to usgoldcorp.gold. U.S. Gold Corp trades on the NASDAQ, which again is very unique for a junior exploration company. The ticker there is USAU. Luke, as we conclude, is there anything else investors should be aware of with U.S. Gold Corp in 2019?
Well, we are working a lot of things behind the scenes, which I'd love to share with you all. But of course, that's not how we work in a very regulated exchange environment. We need to obviously execute and make things public as they come along. But our plan of attack is we've achieved a huge amount of things over at Keystone, that being, of course, really understanding the stratigraphy, the lithology, which is also the aging of the rocks and the aging of these systems. We've done more and extensive geophysics and geochemistry. We feel that we've got two or three high prime candidate targets. Look, a term we used to use a lot at Gold Standard was a halo. You know, you're on the halo of a gold system. You're on the halo of a deposit. We really feel like we've just drilled right close to or on the edge of some really significant systems. You know, there has been analogous gold throughout almost all the holes on the project, which is very key, because if there wasn't gold in the system, looking for a gold deposit would be very challenging. So look for follow-up drilling at Keystone. Look for us to obviously look to advance Copper King, because look, when we bring that through permitting, which is a relatively inexpensive undertaking for us as a small company, but as we bring it through permitting, every milestone that we meet through that permitting process is going to add huge amounts of value to that deposit from the viewpoint of, hey, if US Gold doesn't have the cash in its genes to go about developing the project on its own, well, other than obviously, as I mentioned, interest from the state of Wyoming, there are a lot of interested parties, mid-tier producers, copper and gold producers, who would love to team up on a project like this. It would minimize dilution for us as a company. So there's a slew of different opportunities for us in 2019 that we're exploring. But a lot of catalysts, I feel, can really add value to us in a hurry here in this oncoming drilling season.
Luke, I appreciate you coming on the show and giving us an update, and I look forward to touching base and bringing you back on over the course of 2019 to give us updates.
Yeah, I look forward to it too, Bill. There's so much more to discuss, so look, anytime, and thank you, and thank you to your listeners for taking the time today.
Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.